sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from thy heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues in the many fields of knowledge, all the steps on the path to omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Page 305, and we were just finishing up going through a little journey of how Trungpa Rinpoche presents Shamatha and Vipassana as being the key ingredients in all stages of the three yanas, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, as opposed to something that just is merely a Hinayana practice, but all the other practices are affiliated with one or the other, or the combination. And we went through Abhisheka as being the combination. And then here we have the Trikaya principle. So on the bottom of 306 on the left-hand side, 305, sorry. Working with the Trikaya principle. Combination of Shamatha Vipassana is also connected with this. The practice of Shamatha brings Dharmakaya. And the practice of Vipassana brings Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. So Dharmakaya is higher, but Shamatha at this point of the path is perfected. Shamatha on the nature of reality. And so it has the peacefulness and the stability of Dharmakaya. And Vipassana is required in order to manifest without losing the essence of enlightenment within the Rupakayas of Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. And he breaks them down. Vipassana brings Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya broken down that way. The three are sometimes known as the two. The formless kayas, the Dharmakaya, and the form kayas are Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. It's interesting, at the beginning of the path, we think we're working on a very crude level when we do Shamatha. We just learn how to breathe, how to stop our thoughts, and things like that. Seems to be quite a primitive level. But in fact, we're actually working with the Dharmakaya, with potential Dharmakaya, which is very advanced. The Dharmakaya is a very high level, particularly from the Vajrayana point of view. It is Jnana Dharmakaya, the wisdom aspect altogether. They break down the Dharmakaya into two types, the Jnana Wisdom Dharmakaya and the other is the, what do they call it? I can't remember the term, but it's the possession of capabilities, powers, and strengths. Vijnana Dharmakaya and, sorry. Anyway,
Is that like skillful means?
Well, it's the 10 powers and the 8 fearlessnesses, the 18 qualities of the Dharmakaya generally. So first we have to manifest Dharmakaya, and after that there are post-meditation experiences, awareness practices of the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. We have to rescue the pure strictness of Shamatha by relating with our day-to-day living situation through Vipassana, which experiences which are luminous and bright. We have to rescue Shamatha. It's like saying that we have to arise from Dharmakaya in order to interact with Buddha activity in post-meditation through Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya.
you ever seen this presentation anywhere?
No, I've never seen lots of these. The whole nudros and
Shamatas,
and the paramitas. I've never seen either any of these three.
But wouldn't you say that Mahamudra Shamatha is Dharmakaya? That's pretty traditional.
Do they say that?
That's what Laura Kaufman does, all these readings all the time on Mahamudra Shamatha as being very high, as opposed to the kind of shamatha we do with following the breath itself.
Oh, yeah, it's a transformed. That's what I try to express as being a transformed version of it. But I don't recall it being called Dharmakaya. Does she say that specifically?
I'll check the notes she gave us.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so that is the next section, is the Mahamudra, his presentation. Oh, sorry, the little exploration of it, of visualization and the necessity of the two within that on the next page, under the heading of proper preparation, which is under visualization practice. And this is within the... You dressed up as a lawyer. It says Kriya Yoga, and this is within the Kriya Yoga section of the Profound Treasure, where he goes through the nine yanas and the different tantric yanas. But this note about visualization really applies to visualization at all levels. Kriya Yoga includes the practice of visualization, but there's a danger if you try to jump into this form of the creative use of imagination without having developed shamatha and vipassana practice, which makes you more peaceful and aware. Without shamatha, vipassana, visualization practice can be a very, very big ego trip, unless you have some understanding of mind control or ego control and the experience of relating with neurosis and boredom and so forth. None of these tantric practices will actually be workable at all. And that was the general view that Trungpa Rinpoche had of other teachers who taught visualization practices very early to students, was that it was a waste of time and to some extent even harmful, because if they don't have some grounding in the shamatha vipassana practice, it's just entertainment and missing the point. Then on the next page, Mahamudra. In particular, within what's called path Mahamudra, where there's ground Mahamudra, path Mahamudra, and fruition Mahamudra. This is not something we have time to go into particularly, but shamatha vipassana is much more prominent in the path Mahamudra in terms because of its practice orientation. So insight and relief. The second stage of Mahamudra experiences path. According to Jhāvāna Kāngshō, path Mahamudra is the experience of meditation. Path Mahamudra is connected with greater awareness or the Mahavipassana experience. So that here we have transformed shamatha vipassana, Mahavipassana. We're not abandoning the shamatha vipassana principle here, but we're bringing it along, maturing it further. With Mahavipassana awareness, you witness the physical environment. You witness that the physical environment is the creation of the guru or Vajra master. Because of your awareness, you also realize that speech and sound are the utterance of the Vajra master, and thought expressions are the expressions of the guru mandala. And this kind of awareness, which is connected with body, speech, and mind, means that the world is pliable. So shamatha and vipassana give you the basis for understanding or experiencing the type of view that's carried into practice in Mahamudra system. And then the fruition of Mahamudra is presented in what's called the four yogas, the four stages of accomplishment within the Mahamudra system. And on the right-hand side of the page, we have his presentation of how shamatha vipassana is important in all of the four yoga stages of one-pointedness, simplicity, one taste, and non-meditation are the four. So going back to the original practice of shamatha is important for these four yogas of Mahamudra. Even at the level of non-meditation, which is the fourth, you still do not give up the technique and the style of shamatha and vipassana discipline. You use the same technique, you have the same posture, and the same sense of uprightness all the time. In order to maintain one-pointedness of the first one, it's important to concentrate on mindfulness and awareness. Shamatha is also important for the second, simplicity, since it's necessary to give up any possibility of having some kind of ground to hang on to. It's also important for the third yoga. For through shamatha practice, you begin to realize you're not using your technique as a saving grace. At the level of the fourth non-meditation, you realize that sophistry, such as meditating or not, are all used up. Because you've overcome the habitual patterns of your original backache and your original grandmother problems, which is a way of talking about the sort of subconscious, sort of all-pervasive level of problem that we generally have that are manifest in specific problems. And your original what have yous, you begin to develop a sense of freedom. And from that point of view, shamatha practice is quite practical. Shamatha is always important. You have to maintain a shamatha like precision of body and speech. You have to be in that state all the time. And then skipping to the next page, the last page of our book, we're here at the end. So at the last paragraph, it says, over time, the shamatha technique becomes ingrained. So even when you have attained non-meditation, you do not just collapse, and you don't become an idiot. You always carry your dignity, but at this point you have realized what is known as co-emergent wisdom. Interesting that there's in these sections, there's a focus on shamatha more than even vipassana, where it's like, Vipassana gets perfected and ends up into being sort of joined into shamatha in the sense that once you've understood reality, you don't keep the intellect going, the sort of discriminating awareness part of Vipassana going, but it becomes a sort of pacified experience, continuous experience, I think is the idea. At least that's a dream I had years ago. Okay, so tonight we're jumping into shamatha. See? There you go. And we had a couple of traditional Mahayana presentations, and then a couple of cool Vajrayana presentations. And I'd like to start with Kamala Shiel, who starts on page 26. So everybody knows Kamala Shiel, right? When did he live?
Hundreds.
800s? Is that what you said?
I said 800.
All right, yes. 800s. Who was his teacher?
I'm going to go with the teacher. No. Vasubandhu.
Wait, a teacher is much later, right? What year is a teacher?
1800s?
No, 1100s.
1100s.
Or actually 1000s.
Kamala Shiva, huh? Vasubandhu?
No, he was much earlier. When is Vasubandhu? No.
Garden.
No.
Couldn't be. That's way up there. Kamala Shiva's teacher. The first Karmapa? No, that can't be. I'm just going off now.
Wait. You said 800s. What happens in Buddhism in the 800s?
Padmasambhava goes to Tibet.
Yeah, Padmasambhava gets a plane ticket to Tibet and he goes on his first visit. It's like he marries Mandarava and goes on honeymoon to Tibet. Hey, let's go. Here it is. And why was he brought in by the king of Tibet?
Well, the evil forces that were trying to turn the clock back to the Dark Ages.
In specifically, and what were the Bun spirits doing?
Tearing down the temples.
Tearing down the temple that somebody was trying to build. Who?
The king.
Ah, we got to do the course on history. That settles it. The next course is on history, okay? Sonsen Gambo is the king, the first king. Trisong Detsen invites Shantarakshita to come and bring Buddhism into Tibet. And he's a very scholar, a great monk, scholar. And he organizes the guys to build during the day, you know, they're doing the job of it. And then every night the Bun forces would tear it down. So he says to the king, you got to get like a heavy duty dude who's, you know, has magical power. And I happen to have the email address of this guy, Guru Rinpoche. I recommend Padmasambhava. So, and Shantarakshita, his main student is Kamala Shila. And Kamala Shila, there's a famous thing that he's involved in that happens at Samye between two different versions of Buddhism.
Debate!
They have a big debate, right? Kamala Shila and the Chinese Shua Shuang, right? Yes. And who wins?
The Tibetan.
Yeah. The Tibetan. No, he was Indian. He was Indian.
Right. Where was this famous debate?
Samye.
Which is?
The debate at Samye.
Is that in Tibet?
Yeah,
that's in Tibet. Kamala Shila came to Tibet.
Yeah.
Oh.
Shantarakshita brought him with him.
Oh.
And then left him there to, like, you know, work on the Tibetans.
Except some people say that the Chinese guy won.
Chinese?
Anyway, so he writes a three-part book on the stages of meditation practice called The Stages of Meditation. Catchy title. And part one, two, and three. And part two is the best in terms of, like, presenting the actual practice straightforwardly, and it becomes the like main textbook for meditation practice in all of the Tibetan tradition. Everybody like quotes back to it. And so here's the chapters on Shamatha. Today we'll do Shamatha, and soon we'll do Vipassana. So page 26. First we have the definition. And actually he starts with the order. You know, it's like, which do you do first, the chicken or the egg? Here he says, calm abiding, shamatha should be achieved first. It's that mind which has overcome distraction to external objects and which spontaneously and continuously turns toward the object of meditation with bliss and pliancy. So he's talking about perfected shamatha because he's talking about bliss and pliancy, which are marks of shamatha in the perfected, accomplished state. That which probably examines suchness from within a state of calm abiding. So within shamatha, that which examines the nature of reality is vipassana, special insight. So those are the standard sort of classical definitions that everybody that quotes him on. And he quotes a sutra. They all got to quote a sutra. The Ratnamegha Sutra. Calm abiding meditation is a single-pointed mind. It's special insight. Makes specific analysis of the ultimate. And then from the unraveling of a thought sutra, the Samdhina Mochana Sutra, how should people thoroughly search for calm abiding meditation and gain expertise and special insight? Maitreya, the next Buddha, asks Shakyamuni. Maitreya, I've talked about this to the Bodhisattvas, and he lists all these different places where he's talked about them. He said Bodhisattvas should study these teachings, and then once they understand them, they should go to remote areas and reflect on these. So we have hearing, now we're in contemplating, reflect on these teachings and focus their minds upon them, upon their meaning. They should focus mentally only on the topics they've reflected and maintain this continuously. So once you understand a certain set of teachings, you focus your mind on that. In contemplation, you don't focus your mind on teachings that you haven't understood. You try to bring what you have understood to a different level of experience.
That's still contemplation?
Yes. topics that they've reflected about and maintain this continuity. This is called mental engagement. When the mind has been repeatedly engaged this way and physical, mental, and pliancy have been achieved, that mind is called calm abiding. So, he presents first an unusual situation where you develop calm abiding on topics that are normally the topics of Vipassana. But by limiting your like analysis of them, by focusing only on what you've already understood and not like continuing to explore, you then achieve shamatha and lama. When the bodhisattva has achieved physical and mental pliancy, which is the mark of accomplishment, and abides only in them, he eliminates mental distractions. The phenomena which has been contemplated as the object of inner single-pointed concentration should then be analyzed and regarded as like a reflection. So understanding its emptiness, this reflection or image which is the object of single-pointed concentration should be thoroughly discerned as an object of knowledge. So it should be known in the sense of being a knowable, which is a sort of a little bit of an odd statement, sort of a circular. It should be completely investigated and thoroughly examined. So those two terms are key. Investigated and examined. Practice patience and take delight in it. With proper analysis, observe and understand, and this is what is known as special insight. So not a very helpful overall quote, but anyway, how to practice it. If you're actually interested in practicing, actualizing shamatha, should initially concentrate closely on the fact that the 12 sets of scriptures all lead to suchness. They will lead to it, and they have led. One way of doing this is to set the mind closely on the mental and physical aggregates as an object that includes all phenomena. So that's one of the traditional objects of contemplation. What are the aggregates? It says closely on the mental and physical aggregates. So either singly or as a group. And what's one of the main aggregates?
Form.
Which is, in this case,
physical.
The body.
Body.
Or form, or mind, perception. Another way is to place your image, your mind on an image of the Buddha from the Samadhi Raja Sutra. They always quote this example from this sutra, where the sutra Buddha says, for achieving concentration, you should focus on the body of a Buddha. In this way, place your mind, the mind of an object of your choice, and having done so, do it again. Obstacles and antidotes. We examine and check whether it's properly focused, check for dullness, see whether the mind is distracted. If the mind is found to be dull due to sleepiness and so forth, then the mind should attend to a supremely delightful object such as an image of the Buddha or a notion of light. So how to deal with drowsiness. In this process, having dispelled dullness, the mind should try to see the object then very clearly, having dispelled the sleepiness. You should recognize dullness when the mind cannot see the object very clearly, when you feel as if you're blind or in a dark place or you've closed your eyes. If, which you are in meditation, your mind chases after qualities of external forms, that should be like if, when you are in meditation, sorry. Your mind chases after external objects. Or you're distracted by desire, or you suspect distraction is approaching. Which is another interesting thing, is that your investigation quality of meditation. There's the mindfulness quality and the introspection quality, the shesha, the knowing, present knowing, which we talked about, these two main qualities of shamatha, trenpa and shesha, mindfulness and investigation, or watchfulness, vigilance. And this suspects that distraction is approaching. It can see the mind.
But that's familiar habits, because it does happen before, right?
Yes, so you see that your mind, oh, I know what happened last time. This thought came up where I'm going to think again about the food from the reception that they're serving out there. Last time, I got totally wrapped up in that, and I could feel it coming, so then I release it immediately. And to counter it, you think that everything's impermanent and suffering and so forth. On our next page, thereby eliminate distraction, and with the noose of mindfulness and alertness, the elephant-like mind should be fastened to the tree of the object of meditation, which for us is the breath. So this image of an elephant with a rope tied to a stake or a tree. When you find the mind is free from those defilements and it naturally abides in the object, then you should relax your effort and remain neutral as long as it continues. Which is an interesting point. You don't need to continue to exert effort with the process, but relax with it. You should understand that calm abiding is actualized when you actually enjoy physical and mental pliancy through this process of prolonged familiarity. And the mind gains the power to stay with the object, whatever object it chooses.
At that point, can you untie the elephant?
That's what he's saying. You don't need the rope anymore. So then let's go to page 33, and we'll look at Jhanvi Kongcho's presentation of this material. And when did Jhanvi Kongcho the Great live?
1800s.
So 1,000 years later, let's see what the tradition looks like and how
it's close to the Chinese century.
18 is close to the 19 is very close to the 20.
No, I mean, yeah. The end of the century.
Well, he lived a long time. He basically lived the whole 19th century.
Wow.
Yeah, he's an impressive guy. Okay, so this is from the Treasury of Knowledge. Many of us have looked at this a number of times. You see table of contents on the next page. So it has these five parts. The necessity of practicing and meditating, the presentation of shamatha, the presentation of vipassana, the union of them or the conjoinedness of them, and then a presentation of what types of practices are shamatha and what types are vipassana. And you have a more detailed outline. And then on page 36 of our source book, we start with the necessity. And the lead-in is through the superior knowledge arising from reflection. So that's prajna, arising from reflection. The first prajna, one eliminates misconceptions and finds certainty regarding the deep view. And why is there an ant in here? Yeah, that's a problem. Ants. Regarding the deep view and the general and specific character of phenomena. This understanding should then be applied to one's own being through meditation practice. So once you gain an understanding of general and specific character of phenomena, so basically like the two levels of truth, you then apply that to your own being, body, mind, so forth. Thus this eighth chapter deals with the progressive classifications of training in superior samadhi. One needs to practice by meditating on the meaning of what one has listened to and reflected upon, just as a farmer needs to make use of a good crop. One needs to practice focusing inwardly on what one has understood. No matter how deeply one listens and reflects, if one does not also meditate, one will not be freed from bondage. So skipping the bold are the root verses. So we can focus on the root verses. So what type of samadhi should one practice? One should gain certainty in both shamatha and vipassana, which comprise the ocean of samadhis of both the greater and lesser vehicle. So all meditation practices resolve into shamatha and vipassana. And he quotes the sutra one should know that the many types of samadhi of all the great beings are included in shamatha and vipassana. So skipping to the detailed explanation of the essential nature of these two on the next page, in the bold text on the top of the next page, 27. The essential nature of these is one-pointedness and individual analysis which fully discriminates phenomena. So shamatha is one-pointedness, and vipassana is individual analysis which fully discriminates phenomena. So we're now between Kamalashila and Jhamvan Khosrow, where we're seeing the traditional versions of what vipassana is, which is very different from the panoramic awareness presentation of vipassana that we're accustomed to, at least on the surface. There's a little more nuance to it where they come together, and we'll see that. The commentary says shamatha is to rest the mind one-pointedly using a correct object of observation, and vipassana is to completely analyze suchness. What is suchness? Suchness here is the nature of reality by means of superior knowledge, prajna, that fully discriminates and individually analyzes. So those two types of mental activity, discrimination and individual analysis. Let's see, so skipping to the, the etymology. Now skip the etymology. Let's go to the necessity of both. Just as in the example of the bright oil lamp not blown by the wind, one realizes the true nature by bringing both together. In order to understand the necessity of both of them, consider the oil lamp. If the flame is bright and there's no wind, one can see clearly. However, if the flame is bright but it's being blown about by the wind, one will not see clearly. Similarly, if one has both prajna, which is certain and unmistaking concerning suchness, and concentration, which stays at will on that object of observation, i.e. suchness, one will thereby see reality clearly.
What is the wind, by the way?
What is the wind in the analogy? What do you think?
Distraction?
I think so. Stuffy noses, things like that. This is an interesting little summary here. The progression and the order of the practice is from the support to that which is supported. Commentary says, it's such that one depends upon the other. So the idea is that shamatha is the support, and it supports the development of vipassana. So one progresses from shamatha as the support to vipassana. So in the middle of this paragraph, having first accomplished shamatha, one proceeds to vipassana. In case you were wondering about the order. On the next page, shamatha, the prerequisites. To rely on the conditions for shamatha is to reject everything unfavorable, stay in a favorable area, to have few desires, be content, adopt pure ethics, to give up distraction and discursive thoughts. And at the bottom of the page, we have a little list of these. Staying in a favorable area means to have good facilities. TV, good internet reception, things like that.
Ask us a question. Could that the progression is from the support to that which is supported? Could that be where that Dharmakaya is shamatha and Rupakaya is vipassana, where that comes from? Because isn't Dharmakaya what's underneath Sambhogakaya and Rupakaya? Doesn't it support it?
Yeah, pretty much. I think so.
Thank you.
We're like a parent and children.
Yeah.
Some parents and children.
Yeah.
For what?
Hopefully. Ideally.
To in a wholesome environment where there's no danger from trick-or-treaters, a healthy place free from disease, good friends of like view and conduct, and the requisites for happiness, freedom from commotion and disturbing noise is a little bit repetitive. Having few desires refers to desires for food and clothing. That was the prominent things to be desirous of back way back, you know. Now we have a lot more things to be desirous of, like food and clothing. Being content is being satisfied with just enough. Forsaking excessive activity refers to buying and selling and shopping and things like that, right? Watching TV, playing computer games. Avoiding, adopting pure ethics means not transgressing one's vows of refuge and bodhicitta.
It's like a doctrine.
Yeah, this is a doctrine, that's right. Same thing, Devanti says. Giving up discursive thoughts refers to mental activity, which results in many shortcomings in this and future lives. The progressive classification, when classified it, what's the it here?
Shamatha,
thank you. Comprises the mind of the desire realm, the concentrations, the formless absorptions, and the absorption of cessation. So these are the different stages or cumulative stages of shamatha. So when it's classified, there's four types. The shamatha, which corresponds to the mind of the desire realm, which is us, we're in the realm, in the desire realm of the three realms, desire, form, and formless, to the levels of the concentrations, to the, which is the absorptions in the form realm, to the formless absorptions, and then at the very top of existence, the absorption of cessation. And these were explained previously and will be in the next chapters, which we don't have here. Posture. Comfortably in the eightfold posture, not the six points, but the all eight here. See if you can find the ones that we no longer list in the six points. The legs should be in the Vajra posture, or at least half crossed. The eyes should be half closed. The body should be held straight. The shoulders should be level. The gaze should be in the direction of the nose. What direction is the nose? What does that mean?
Slightly down, down.
What if you have like a ski slope now? Down, but to like to the left or the right?
No.
No, to the center, right? You see, you look down to the center. Just checking.
But you can just, even if you do that, you can just barely see the tip of your nose. It's not an essential division, it's so peripheral.
So, but do we have our eyes crossed, like we're looking at the tip of the nose, or we just look in the direction of?
The direction.
I would say the direction.
Okay. There should be a slight gap between the teeth and between the lips, and the tongue should be touching the palate, and the breath should be natural and effortless.
It's those two, the mouth and the teeth.
Uh-huh. What about the shoulder? We don't have the shoulders, right?
We don't have the tongue. Should we touch your palate?
It's not one of the six, but Rinpoche does talk about it.
Yeah,
it gives it. He says the mouth should be open slightly.
If it's number one,
that's six, and seven is the tongue touching the palate.
Well, he said that you should do that.
But. In order so that the saliva goes down rather than in the mouth.
I'm serious.
That's exactly what he says.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
It's not relaxing.
So you don't drool, you're not making a drool.
Yeah, you're still
a little apron. the optics of observation. Here we have a little obscure reference to this systematic way of classifying possible objects for meditation. That, you know, what are we going to meditate on? We all just meditate on what?
The breath.
The breath, or
whatever
what else
arises.
Do we say? Whatever arises. What do you meditate on? Anyone else? Anything else? Is there anything else?
Foundations? The body? Feelings?
There could be nothing else. I'm just asking.
Small stone.
I don't know, meditate on, you know, whatever you're obsessed with, right? Wow, how do you make it? Cool. Okay, so there's four objects of observation. It's not a particularly important topic for us, but we do happen to have a chart on it.
The chart of every meditation object?
Yes. Well, something like that.
Classified, at least. This is the declassified. No, I mean the classification.
Is it very adapted?
Yeah.
First things you might notice is that these topics are not mutually exclusive. Some topics appear in more than one place. Thank you. Right, so like the five aggregates appears in 1C1I, right? You got the five aggregates, and then it reappears in 3A. So these are not mutually exclusive lists. The most familiar category is objects for purifying deeds, which are the remedies for people like me. Let's see, what are the remedies to whichever of the greatest tendencies come from the deeds committed in former lives or moments, from passion, aggression, and ignorance, and pride, and so forth. So here you have ugliness, and what are the top, what do you meditate on if you're attached to sexuality? You meditate on ugliness, and the 36 types of ugliness pertaining to the body. That's funny. How do you deal with excessive desire?
Satisfied.
Love, in order to, this is not to eradicate love, but to generate love. Focus on another, on other loved, hated. Focus on hated people and generate love towards them. Focus on dependent arising. Fourth is the four elements: earth, water, fire, air. Six elements: space and consciousness. All out. And then here we are. We're in 2E is our practice, breath. As it moves in and out, that's where we are. So we use the breath as the this one is said to be the sort of universal purification object of purification. It's like the long explanation for these other ones are that if you have a focus on desire, you meditate on ugliness. If you have a focus on hatred, or if that's your major klesha, hatred, you contemplate love. If your major klesha is ignorance, you meditate on dependent arising. I can't, the constituents, I think that's like arrogance or pride. And then if you have an equal tendency for all the other kleshas, then you do the meditation on the breath.
And they also associate that with discursiveness, right?
And this excessive discursiveness, that's right. So that's our diagnosis these days, generally across the board. And so the remedy is breath meditation. The others are relatively obscure, and we'll move on. But it's a nice, very nice presentation of them. Anyway, he says on page 41, after this list of four. And we'll come back to the other side, the flip side of this album shortly. The object of observation chosen should be in accordance with the individual, depending on whichever affliction is strongest, from desire to discursiveness, the object of observation should be the corresponding remedy, from repulsiveness to the rising and falling of the breath. If the tendencies are of equal strength and the afflictions are weak, it's permissible to use any object of observation. So the progression of the actual meditation. So the progression goes from settling the mind with a concrete support and then skipping and just for a moment looking at the headers, setting the mind with concrete support, without, first with concrete, then without concrete. You no longer need the mafia. And then setting the mind in the essential nature. Those are the three stages of shamatha. In this sort of blended tradition by the time of Jhamana Khonsho, of the Mahamudra tradition and the standard tradition of shamatha with its nine stages. So the particular, going back to the concrete support on page 41, the particular method for setting the mind is to focus on impure and the pure support. In the beginning, it's important to train using a support. An impure support refers to any small object which one uses as an object of concentration. A pure one refers to any representation of the Buddha or any sort of dharmic emblem or the attributes of a deity and so forth. Concentration should be similar to the way a Brahmin twines his cord, neither too tight nor too loose. Without concrete support refers to setting the mind on individual parts or on the complete form outwardly and inwardly on the body and that which depends on the body. Once one is able to rest even slightly on a concrete support, one can proceed to meditate without concrete, i.e. using a mental image of a deity, of a statue of a deity, etc. First one concentrates on individual parts, such as the face and hands and so forth. This is known as meditation with partial support, partial concrete support. Then, having become familiar with that, one concentrates on the complete form as one whole. This is known as meditation with a complete non-concrete support. Sorry, I said concrete a second ago.
Non-concrete.
Non-concrete, thank you.
Are these translations like that partial thing, is that sort of a, I thought that was a little weird in terms of the way they're just...
Yeah, it's like, you know, Pulup describes it without, I think, giving those terms. He says there's two ways to do it. One is you start with like one area of the deity.
Right.
And you go through each area and build it up. And the other is you just do the full-blown thing.
Right, yeah. I mean, that
without categorizing it.
That's definitely part of the tradition. I just wondered whether this partial translation is kind of a weird usage because it partial and parts are not really the same, you know?
Yeah,
if I heard partial, it would never make me think what we actually do when we do parts, you know.
at one point we were given the instruction to start with feeling the presence of what you're visualizing and then, you know, start in with filling it in.
Yeah, that's a good way to start. That's actually a really helpful way to start. That's cool.
Are you a part of a mental image?
Well, the deity is the mental image. So instead of doing the whole deity all at once, you do a hand.
It's a conceptual idea.
Yeah, conceptual idea. And as Cynthia was just pointing out, this language around parts and stuff is sort of
But they're literally
clunky.
Telling you to do that. Like, take your image and do it.
Well, ultimately you want to be able to have a shamatha experience of the whole deity. And deity visualization is shamatha practice. In that sense, and so, but in order to get there, it's helpful to start with part.
It's
if you've ever done deity practice, It's like training wheels. Yeah.
I say yes.
It's hard to do the whole deity all at once, particularly if it's a complicated deity.
And it helps with precision.
Yeah.
Because if you do the whole and you never do the parts, you may just
it's all fuzzy. You can't remember who it is, what they look like. Here we have an interesting quote from this text by Zhangshu Zongpo. Shamatha is classified into observation, which is directed outwards, and attainment, which is directed inwards. Observation is of two kinds, special, which refers to statues and seat syllables, and ordinary. So this is just another scheme that's similar to what we went through. Concrete support is outward, is observation, and it had impure, which is stones or a candle you might use or a flower, and then pure is a deity or something.
And so dharmic and non-dharmic, I guess you could say.
Yes. So it's just another scheme. So let's skip, given the time. And then finally we have setting the mind in the essential nature. So the idea is that this is a progression. It's not like three different things, you know, that you might, I'm going to pick this one and use that for the rest of my life. But actually the practice itself progresses in this way. So really, the progression, like the quote from the Buddha, the Samadhi Raja Sutra implies, they don't give the whole quote, but generally, but the scheme is that you would start with a statue of the Buddha as a concrete support, and then you would focus on the visualized image of that as a non-concrete support, and then you would experience the mind. You would turn your object of shamatha to be not the reflection that's appearing in the mind, but the mind's reflective quality, the mind's capability. So here we have that. Strive to remain absorbed in the essential nature. Waves of thought having dissolved into the ocean of the all basis, the alaya vijnana. The alaya, not the vijnana. Having familiarized oneself with the methods mentioned above, one settles into the state in which all notions of subject and object are completely pacified, with no concept of a support. Here the endless flow of thought waves is completely dissolved into the ocean of the all basis, and one arrives in a state of absorption in the essential nature. This is the ultimate shamatha, therefore strive for it. And this is where shamatha and vipassana come together. It's really like, in order to experience this shamatha, you have to understand vipassana. So it's sort of like you have the first two levels of shamatha, and then it leads to and then you would explore vipassana. And then when you have some sense of what the essential nature is, the all basis is, then you would be able to do shamatha on that.
Because to rest in the essential nature, you have to identify the essential nature.
Exactly, thank you.
So there would be a vipassana happening.
Exactly, in order to identify it, and then you come back, and then you do shamatha on that object that you've identified with vipassana.
Resting
vipassana goes back, exactly. Turns into this, and sort of combines into this. So like, we'll come to resting vipassana in a minute, but that's sort of this similar to this shamatha.
Would you just say something about that understanding the essence was like the object, or this is supposed to be objectless incident?
It's, sometimes it's called objectless in the sense that there's no external object. But
it says all notions of subject and objects. And then, I just wonder if that's...
It's emptiness.
Well, you're basically absorbed in the nature of mind. So whether you want to consider that the mind as an object or the mind staying within itself as being without object. Different people have different views. You know, Tsongkhapa makes a big argument that this shamatha has as its object the mind.
So you're being
equivocal
in this case?
Being
ecumenical.
So what happens when you try to meditate? There's two ways of identifying these experiences. There's the traditional of the great treatises, And here we find the eight antidotes to the five faults. The three types of laziness, forgetting the instructions, laxity, and agitation. Non-application and over-application. I think I screwed it up. Three types of laziness is one fault. Forgetting the instructions.
It's two.
I can't come up with five.
Laxity and agitation is three. Non-application is four. And over-application is five.
Oh, laxity and agitation, yeah. Right, are the ones that he takes as together.
They often
Thank
do
you.
That. They always do that. Often. Which I always thought was weird. But
well, Sakya Rinpoche does six. He splits them.
That's true. Well, they say that sometimes lower, that they say if you split them, you're six. But it's fairly common even in our traditional discussion, they used to combine them.
And then the eight antidotes on the next page are aspiration, exertion, and faith, and suppleness. So the first four antidotes counteract the three types of laziness. The samadhi of not forgetting, with the three particularities, whatever the heck that is, we'll find out. Examination, application, and equanimity. Let's see. Okay, so let's skip to the, as to the five faults, they are as follows. So here we have the more extensive presentation that links up the, not yet. We don't have the linking up with the antidotes yet. So first fault, at the time of engaging in samadhi, laziness is a fault. It prevents application of the practice. There's three types. Laziness of neutral activities, such as sleepiness, attachment to negative activities or busyness, and lack of self-confidence is a type of laziness. Forgetting the instructions when exerting oneself in samadhi is a fault. When you're already resting in equipoise, then you experience laxity and agitation. Those become hindrances since they make the mind unworkable. And so as soon as you actually start applying the technique in our practice, the mind reacts and churns up activity. Either you go to sleep, you get really tired, or your mind goes completely haywire. Each of them has two levels, a coarse or a gross and a subtle. And the coarse agitation cannot be suppressed even by remedies due to its strong attachment to sense objects, while subtle agitation refers to the slight movement of thought, the mind being unable to rest undisturbed. Non-application of remedies when these two have arisen is a fault, since one is then unable to pacify them. And continuing to apply remedies when one is free from them is a fault, since one then is unable to rest in equanimity.
It's interesting,
the
fact that a coarse agitation has no remedy, is unable to be tamed by any remedy. So does that mean they just sort of say there's nothing you can do about that other than just...
I think what they're implying, which is not that well expressed in the translation, is that you have to work on the attachment to the sense objects, as opposed
to
the
symptom
itself.
Yeah, it's funny. Yes, it doesn't seem like you're saying something there.
Yeah, it's weird
that they don't have something.
Yeah, they never say forget it, you're hopeless.
Right.
Okay, so the very last line on this page 43, the remedy to these five is to rely on the antidotes. So here we have the application. The first four, namely aspiration. So cultivating the aspiration for practice, like throughout the day, so that it becomes a priority in your mind and then in your schedule. Exerting yourself, maybe you get up out of bed maybe 5 minutes earlier than normally. Faith, so having confidence in the practice, that the practice works as the cause, and suppleness. The effect, so experiencing some level of result from the practice. These remove the first four faults of laziness.
Is the parenthetic thing for because referring to just that one or all three of the first ones?
No, I think just that one. The faith is the cause, then results in suppleness. It's a little bit uncommon characterization.
Well, I was wondering if... And clearly, suppleness, which is what we're talking about, Xinjiang, right?
Yes.
So that's clearly result or fruition.
Well, these levels of Xinjiang.
Right.
This is the very first incipient level.
I wonder if all the other three are considered. I don't know. It seems like...
The remedy to forgetting is the samadhi of not forgetting. It's to remember the instructions. Just keep trying, which has three particular: strong clarity of mind, non-discursiveness, and a resulting experience of bliss, which is accompanied by a sensation of well-being. And so this is, I don't know, if you've heard this talk, I'll go through shamatha, he talks about the three qualities of shamatha as being having strength, familiarity and penetrating, stableness.
Stability, clarity, and strength.
Stability, the clarity, he often uses a different word for, doesn't he? Stability, clarity, strength. It gives
non-discursiveness would be stability.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, so these three qualities of not forgetting become, in other words, there's a play on the word forgetting, which the opposite of not forgetting is remembering, which is a translation for mindfulness. So basically at this phase of the practice where you're actually starting to practice finally, you've gotten through laziness with those four antidotes, so you're actually doing the practice. And so the first phase of the actual meditation is mindfulness, remembering what you're doing, recollection, coming back into the present over and over and over again. What am I trying to do? The sixth remedy then is introspection, the other of the two main qualities of shamatha, introspection or vigilance, the watcher, awareness, which examines whether laxity and agitation have arisen. If they have, one counteracts them by means of appropriate visualizations and so on. So then you apply little gimmicks if they have arisen to eliminate them. Raising the gaze, lowering the gaze, wash your face with water, slapping yourself, things like
coffee.
Walking meditation. Check your email, check your iPhone. The antidote for non-application of the remedies to laxity and agitation is, believe it or not, to observe oneself. So this is an oblique reference that's not well explained, but basically the idea is that after you have some handle on laxity and agitation, which are the main obstacles to shamatha, after you sort of have the ability to counter them and have achieved a somewhat tranquil, and you achieve like a little glimpse of tranquility in your practice, there's a tendency to let go and just try to glide in that state and relax in that state. And then what happens is that you normally what happens is you shift into subtle thought, like a murky level of mind. So they talk about the different, in the pond or the ocean, the different strength of discursiveness and thought, and that there's a subtle undercurrent of thought going on all the time. And when you have an initial experience of relaxation and meditation from having overcome the more gross and coarse ones, then you settle in and you don't see the subtle level of thought that's going on.
So what do you do?
And they say, so you have to continue to apply the antidotes.
But what are you antidoting,
You're basically, you're antidoting distraction, coarsity and laxity. But it's subtle coarsity and laxity. So
you don't know that you're distracted.
You don't notice the coarsity, the coarsity, the agitation and laxation, laxativeness. Laxation.
So you have to think.
Laxity.
Not good enough. Right?
You have to continue to be aware that you've sunk into a more subtle level of thought, agitation, or that your mind is sinking. You know, there's a dullness that grows.
And this is how would you know? I mean, it sounds like...
You have to introspection. So that's the idea, is that the introspection needs to get stronger, continue to get stronger.
Okay. I'm being entertained.
So, Jared, that based on last week, we were talking about the watcher, and you're talking about introspection. Is this sort of the insightful watcher?
Yeah, Rinpoche calls it the transcendent watcher. Didn't we see that recently, the transcendent watcher?
So last week we were talking about the watcher.
I think so. Yeah, because he was talking about how in Vajrayana it disappears completely, right? We read that. But before that, the watcher was very important.
So the sort of critical obsessive watcher transforms into sort of a
light-handed watcher. But a more refined, like...
But also with insight, because the watcher is saying you're getting too wound up, you're falling asleep, now I need to apply the antidote.
The watcher gets more refined as you go from coarse obstacles, introspection as an antidote to coarse obstacles. Then when you dispel those, you naturally experience the subtle obstacles, and so you need a more subtle level of introspection. And so maybe it goes from, you know, he uses this analogy of not being a mouse watching for a cat.
So that's sort of catching the arising of something.
Yeah, which is similar like what Pulin Rinpoche talks about later in his reading, where you see thought as if it arises and release it earlier instead of like...
After the fact.
Yeah. 10 yards down the line or a minute into the train of thought. If you can measure thought. Thoughts are generally 15 yards or so.
So would you say the watcher then has its own sort of co-emergent quality to it?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Transforms big time. Right? And then when you've actually uprooted the subtle, and so by the way, there's various not that many places, but here and there, there's places where teachers point out that this is one of the main problems that longer-term meditators experience. And I think the Sakyam talks about this, is that there's a tendency to think that your shamatha is like working because you don't have the larger agitation and laxity going on anymore. And to get lazy about your practice, and people just go into sort of a zone and they don't have the light on. And different teachers use this expression of like, it's like okay, you've gotten out of the storm and now you're in a room, but the room is dimly lit. You got to turn the lights up, you know, your meditation has to be lit up, has to get electrified, has to be vivid, has to have that strength.
Isn't
of clarity
in the six stages of the ninth
yeah
stages?
We'll look at those in a second and see what these affiliate
so like
to
a danger point in there where you think I've got it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then at a certain point when you've conquered that phase, you need to then relax into equanimity. If you keep like pushing, then it creates more disturbance, which is this last antidote. If when resting undisturbed in a balanced state, one still makes efforts, then the remedy is to train in equanimity. And then he goes through these other categories, these other traditional categories. And first is what's called the six powers. And personally, I find this the most helpful as a way of mapping, like, what are the energies that you go through in the progression of shamatha practice. First, you listen, you hear the instructions, and it's like you're trying to figure out, you know, why do they do that? Why is there no in-breath? And why am I labeling thoughts? And really trying to understand the instructions. So that's listening. And then reflecting is like you're trying to apply it and you're trying to see in your own mind and experience, well, what does it mean to be present? What does it mean to watch thoughts? What is this, what, you know, reflecting, contemplating on the instructions? And then finally you're able to like do it. You like get the thing, and you're doing mindfulness, and you're being precise, and you're seeing your breath for the first time, and you're seeing your thoughts, you're seeing the aches and pains in your body, you're seeing your habitual patterns arising in the memories and the obsessions of mind and the habitual pattern of always wanting to be occupied and so forth. And then you develop introspection, you develop this capability of, it's sort of like you realize that by watching really carefully, you can dispel the obstacles, the antidotes. You can increase your mindfulness if you introspectively look at, well, what is actually mindfulness? What is the feeling of when I'm really mindful versus when I think I'm mindful? So that whole vigilance or watchfulness really grows in that next phase. And then it shifts into a place where applying the antidotes of sort of energizing your shamatha results in a more joyous or pleasurable experience of meditation. And so one actually likes to exert oneself to turn the light on, to clarify, to make the practice clear and vivid, because it results in a really vibrant state of being. And then finally, the power of familiarity here is that you don't have to keep cranking it up. That becomes unnecessary at some point. You can actually get into that stage and relax into it without having to continually sort of push to be more aware. The four levels of mental engagement are not all that helpful. So settling the mind. So the first four are really mindfulness, are going through this power of mindfulness. The first one involves having developed listening and reflection and uprooting the first obstacles, laziness. And then, so 1 through 4, it's really developing mindfulness, one-pointedness, setting the mind, continuing to set the mind again, resetting the mind again, and then finally close setting, where your mind is relatively staying present, staying in the present. And then and then 5, 6, 7 seem to be affiliated with the investigation quality, the vigilance quality. By seeing the result of mindfulness, you see when you're mindful and when you're not.
Awareness.
Pacifying, having you identify the fault of distraction. You actually very clearly see in what way it's deteriorating your practice. And then thorough pacifying, attachment and mental discomfort are pacified. Again, that's sort of like the accomplishment of vigilance. And then making one pointed, making effort in order to be able to rest effortlessly. So that's the joyous effort in the fifth power. And then setting an equipoise, resting in equanimity when the mind is already balanced, is the sixth power, the power of familiarity. So that's the tradition in the Great Treatise is referring to texts by Maitreya and Asanga primarily. Is what's called the Great Treatise. And so then the second tradition is the tradition of oral instructions. And here we have the five experiences: agitation, attainment, familiarity, stability, and perfection, which are illustrated by examples. And here's what we often use when teaching meditation. First experience of agitation is the waterfall. And that's the first thing one experiences when you actually start practicing. And you think, oh, I can't do this. It's getting worse. My mind is just going freaking crazy. And then we have a sense of attainment. Finally, it's like you make it through that intense waterfall phase. There's a little bit of relaxation, tiny bit, but the mind is still churning up. So the river flowing through a gorge, and then it, you know, progressively gets more and more pacified. Large river flowing leisurely, an ocean free from waves, and then finally an oil lamp not blown by the wind. Usually we stop at the ocean free of waves, but here it's the fifth one is sort of going into Vipassana. The measure of accomplishment. Sorry.
I kind of have a meditation question based on these, because it's kind of the higher levels of what we just read. When we're dealing with subtle laxity and coarseness, and we might even be doing a shamatha technique or shamatha vipassana technique of the breath might have even fallen away. Uh-huh. I imagine we might be on a retreat, I'm thinking, from my own experience.
Yeah.
And where things do get somewhat more subtle, the question is, you can't use a heavy hand of like, oh, I'm coming back, because there's almost nothing, like the old original technique that you give to a new student or that I use when I first did it, that seems too heavy-handed to come back.
Yeah.
So it seems, and this is why I want to ask, it seems like the instruction is like, just be sure that you notice the tremors in the movement. Like that almost works to slowly resolve them by noticing, because if you don't notice, you don't have a chance.
Right.
So is that it? This is my question. Is that it? Is like, just notice, and it will begin to even become more bright, as you say.
Well, just, it means you're aware.
Right.
It is, basically, you can either be having subtle things and not really be aware of them.
Right, so is that the level of doing we have to do? We just have to be at the level of mindful and aware, but then there's nothing really to...
Nothing to do.
We don't have to squat them or come back.
No.
Just aware.
Yes.
It seems like there is a slight, I don't know, it seems like there is a slight shift that you do make mentally, like...
This is my question. Yes.
If you just notice that you sort of could get stuck in noticing, so it's like, is it only, oh, maybe only by disowning it slightly, or... it seems like there's some effort in there that you need to... do more than notice.
But then, I mean, the other thing is that when you do notice it, what actually happens to that? Right? I mean, when you become aware of something, what happens ultimately?
See, I think there's two sides to this. There's the in the cushion side where you can just play with it, like what happens with it. And then there's the being able to put it into words, like when we're talking about it and a student were to ask a meditation instructor to be able to verbalize it.
My hunch is that it shifts to an energetic experience.
Mm.
It shifts out of the sort of watcher mind quality into more of like a somatic or like a sense field experience, and that is how you then turn the light on, and that is how you experience clarity and vividness. To connecting with the energy of the body, the energy of sensation, in the way that he talks about in the second mindfulness.
You rest in the equanimity. Because
well, that's the next stage.
Or you even just tune into the disturbance, you're saying, the energetic.
Well, right.
You tune into it rather than ignoring it.
Yeah, so that's what I'm affiliating with joyous energy, joyous effort. Is that, you know, the tendency is to look at the symptom, at the problem, right? And you shift to the cause, which is the agitation, as you said. It's that fundamental vibration inside that has a physical sort of energetic quality to it.
It sounds a little future-oriented. Making an effort in order to be able to rest. No, just sort of getting ready to rest. Effortlessly.
No, you are doing something. You, like what you're saying is you actually do something. You're saying your attitude shifts.
Yeah.
How you're viewing it shifts. Rather than just noticing it, you're... Maybe it's actually you're feeling it more?
That's what it seems to me. Okay. It seems totally a feeling.
Feeling it, yeah.
That seems to work for me, where it's like I shift out of my the sort of watcher up here, and I feel the energy field in my body.
Mm-hmm.
And that shifts me into a higher level of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates that sort of effort, and it has that pleasurable feeling to it. I don't know.
Thank you for indulging.
I don't know. We don't talk about these things that much in groups, but we could talk
about it. Well, just because we always go so fast over the upper level.
Yeah.
Class, but
yeah. So it's actually connecting into this next thing of the suppleness. You know, so starting to get a sense of what they're calling suppleness is, which is Shinjong, which is synchronization of body and mind, where it's like the momentum that you've created through years of sitting, years of applying the technique. It's like gaining the confidence that you don't have to actually, what you guys were saying initially, is you don't have to do anything at a certain point. Which is what you were saying, right?
Right.
You don't have to. It's like you don't have to continue to apply the antidote of coming back and like the way he describes the third foundation of effort, where he says
third foundation.
Yeah, where you don't have to like. Well, effort. He says like mindfulness of effort is the third one, where he. In the Heart of the Buddha version, the version that's in Heart of the Buddha, he has this description. I think it was in here. I get a little confused, but where he says, you don't have to, like, come back in this clunky way. Like, you have to, initially when we're meditating, we notice our distraction, and we sort of have to intentionally bring ourselves back. Right? And then gradually, you realize that as soon as you notice you're distracted, you're already here, right? And so, but it takes a while to have the confidence to experience that. Because it's like your mind thinks, oh, even though I know I'm here, I have to like bring myself back and reestablish the technique and everything. And gradually it's like you've never left, you know, so gradually you realize you don't have to come, you know, do this process of coming back. And gradually you realize that you never went away. If that makes any sense.
Being able to relax, it sounds like.
Well, it's like having so much confidence in your being here, and your frame of reference has expanded. So that the mind wandering is not a wandering. It's like initially we have a frame of reference that's like the breath and the posture, and it's like anything else is going away from that. And then as your frame of reference expands, thoughts don't leave that expanded frame of reference, because the frame of reference is larger. If that makes any sense.
Right, in a sense, your sense of presence has grown as well, as you're talking
yes.
about. And from what he was describing anyway, it sounds like we're really talking about the difference between waves and little tiny ripples. You know, that really much more subtle level. So, you know, you've got stronger presence and smaller ripples combined, which, yeah, it's really nothing.
Yeah, so to continue that analogy, like with the waves, it's like we feel like we got to work with the waves. We got to apply antidotes and stuff. And with the ripples, you basically have the ability to stay in the depths of the water.
Mm.
And instead of having to deal with the ripples at all, you just pay attention to the depths.
Right, your perspective, actually, yeah, your perspective has shifted from being like on top, riding on top,
right,
to being the
to
whole
being,
ocean.
Yeah.
And just, so therefore, it just seems like a little tiny.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like there's some sort of explicit warning, like don't ignore the ripples too much, though.
Yes, definitely.
Murkiness? If you ignore definitely. The ripples, yeah. Is that the murkiness?
Kind of, yeah.
If you ignore them, they won't go away, so
that's
they'll
right.
stay a little murky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you ignore that you are in the ripples, then you're in the murkiness. If you don't notice that there are ripples, then you're in ripples. You're in the ripples, right? That's the murkiness. Right. So first, you know, there's
murkiness
dealing with
the
waves.
Word, though, because
yeah.
murkiness also implies almost more like sinking and drowsiness sort of thing.
Well, it has both agitation and.
But okay, yeah, I don't know. Murkiness is kind of. Funny.
But murkiness implies more the drowsiness part.
Yeah, yeah.
So the.
It seems like.
The subtle.
Details maybe. The details of it.
Subtle dullness would be murkiness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Subtle agitation would be, the undercurrent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of thought.
Yeah.
The continuous undercurrent of thought, of like it's sort of like. When you know you have to be somewhere at a certain time or do something important, like you have to do a presentation, and it sort of hangs over your head. It's like there in the back of your mind all the time. That's like a pronounced version of the undercurrent. Whereas in the meditation practice, there's usually this undercurrent of less pronounced things, of like, I'm a human being, and I'm sitting in the house, and Tuesday, or that's sort of the undercurrent. So let's see, it's accomplished when suppleness is brought to perfection. The signs are bliss, clarity, and no concepts of designation as if merged with space. Oh, space. I love the sign out there mixing mind with space.
Mm-hmm.
But, so these are the three main like signs of progress as well as potential roadblocks that are mentioned in the Jigme Lingpa text that Rinpoche translates as Mahaati that we saw early on and that we saw somewhere else recently in the seminary, in the 73 seminary, the mindfulness of body at the end, we skipped it. It was one of the four mindfulnesses. I think the fourth one, mindfulness of mind, where he then, we just went through the first part of that talk, and the second part was he goes into these experiences, bliss, clarity, or luminosity. So you should understand clarity, luminosity, translation of same term. Neither of them really means light, right? Think also knowing. Clarity is the light of knowing, right? Which, you know, light is an image, is a metaphor there, but it's not light as opposed to darkness. It's important to understand that, because I think many people think, oh, when you're like when we talk about visualization, you have clarity in the visualization. We think, oh, it's a bright. Like visualization is bright.
It says, without shadows.
Without what?
Shadows. the clarity is complete.
Right, it's all enveloping.
Yeah,
that's good. And no concepts of designation is emptiness. Like, no thought. So even if you accomplish the fourth mental engagement, which is the top of the ninth mental abiding, if one has not also attained this pliancy, suppleness of mind and body, it's not actually shamatha. And he gives some quotes to support that. So let's see what he says. What is this suppleness? In the middle, he quotes from the Compendium of Knowledge, which is the Abhidharma Samuchaya by Sangha. It is that which dispels all hindrances to workability of body and mind, since it breaks the continuity of physical and mental rigidity. Physical and mental rigidity refers to the inability to use body and mind for whatever virtuous purposes one wishes. Remedy suppleness, a little bit circular. Huh? being free from rigidity is the antidote to rigidity.
Clearly, that's a little weird thing to say. Selflessness is what you really should say is practice is the path to get to selflessness, right? It's kind of crazy, really.
Yeah, but when you read the descriptions of it, it's very much of a physical experience. And so I think it has this quality of like finally coming out of the obsessive experience of being in our heads and being more in our bodies. And I think it really is related to Rinpoche's presentation of the second foundation of mindfulness, where he talks about, he calls it livelihood initially, and then he calls it liveliness, and then in one version of the three that he does on these four, he calls it life force. Very much affiliating it with Xinjiang, the energetic quality of the body.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you're bringing out, the funny contradiction of the fact that the antidote is just doing the opposite of the problem, like, which always used to drive, when I first learned these, it used to drive me crazy, yeah. Because I would keep looking at that logically, as you're saying, and say, that's not an antidote, just... And I finally, it's after banging my head against that wall for a long time, I finally realized that it's more of a quality of, like, just do it. You know, you just have to recognize it's like, you know, you forget, so you just have to remember. There is no, it's not like there's a before and then a path and an after. It's just like you have to just do it. You have to shift your mindset to... But it's weird that they call them what they do because it makes it sound like this is really a remedy when it's really just like get over it.
So let's look at the very last paragraph on the page. So mental suppleness arises first. The mental feeling of sort of clicking with the meditation practice. And by its power, a particular prana flows throughout the body, causing the overcoming of physical rigidity and the attainment of physical suppleness. This is the explanation given in this text, The Levels of Heroes by Sangha, the Shravakabhumi. This physical suppleness is a particular and extremely pleasant inner physical tactile sensation. Feelings.
Feelings. No, it's not.
But there are sometimes it feels like the physical, especially when they say if you get your body in a particular posture and can relax, and that allows your mind to relax.
Yeah.
And this is sort of saying the opposite.
Yeah, I think it has that, and it has that progression where first the body gets comfortable, and then the mind gets comfortable, and then the body gets really comfortable. The body gets very energized.
Where you feel it, like it's already there. You can feel it.
It's like you've released it finally.
Yeah.
So on the next page on the top, it's explained as follows. First, a subtle experience, a subtle suppleness arises, which is difficult to recognize, and then a more obvious one, which is easier, and then after this, great bliss and joy pervade both body and mind. At that point, one feels very confident due to this joy by continuing to meditate without attachment to it, which is a key point. Because of its pleasurableness, eventually the shadow-like suppleness which will arise by the power of which one attains shalom. So the shadowness is like the sort of extremely joyful quality of it is set to subside. And then it becomes much more of a subtle suppleness.
Is it like the same kind of joy that we have to let go of on one of those boonies?
Yes. And so through this, one becomes naturally stable and clear. And let's see what else. It helps eliminate the five hindrances, such as the desire for sense objects and sleep and so forth. And also you have the six supernormal powers. So the necessity of accomplishing shamatha, it's the foundation of all concentration and suppresses all suffering affliction.
Actually, can I ask one question on the paragraph before that?
Yeah.
The paragraph before, where it describes...
There's no feeling in the body during the absorption phase, and mind is merged with space.
Upon rising from meditation, one feels as if the body had suddenly reappeared. So I just wanted to... How does that compare with spacing out? Because obviously they're talking about something completely different, but there's an aspect of this that seems like where you could sort of zone out and come back, and it's sort of like, oh, here I am. But this is different than that?
Well, Punlop describes that precisely, right? Did you read Punlop's
Skill? Yeah, I guess I should read that, yeah.
He exactly explains how it differs from spacing out. We don't have time to really do. There was basically too much reading for this one, and there might be for the next one. So we might want to acknowledge that. And
maybe we can do Punlop next class.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, let's go through those, that one reading, and we may not finish the Vipassana one, so we may add a class into the next calendar year to go through them all. Let's see, but did we finish?
Sorry.
Yeah, pretty much, right? Okie doke. Oh, and the other side of the page, this is a chart I think many of you have seen before. It's an old favorite.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so we have, Shamatha Vipassana talk. And on the left, we have with concrete support and without concrete and the essential nature. We have Esther.
No, that's the one that's...
Ah, thank you. Yeah. That's the traditional one. Thanks.
Yeah.
And then next week we'll get into the two types of Vipassana and all its categorization. Yeah, this will be more helpful. It's focused on Vipassana. With that, we head back out into the Halloween of the Halloween. Shall we dedicate the merit?
By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy of wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the radiant wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound.